Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. School began at CMS this morning, but as students and teachers file back into classrooms, education continues to be a battleground in the culture wars. This morning marks 70 days until Election Day, and a key race is on the North Carolina ballot. It pits Republican Michelle Morrow, who in the primary defeated the current state superintendent of public instruction, Catherine Truitt, and Morrow is now running against Democrat Mo Green. Morrow is an activist and registered nurse who homeschools her children. Green is the former superintendent of Guilford County Schools. Normally, this race would only attract a moderate attention, but because of comments made in the past by Morrow, the race has gained national attention. Michelle Morrow has referred to public schools as indoctrination centers and suggested on social media that prominent Democrats, including the president, should be executed. For that reason, her opponent has said she should not be a leader of children. Meanwhile, Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson is running for governor. He, too, is known for controversial remarks, and he, too, has criticized the public schools. Recently, he said he would reject federal education dollars because they come with too many strings attached. Should we be alarmed by comments like that, or had they come from individuals who had made less incendiary comments in the past, would we be able to look at them with clearer eyes? We'll try to do that this hour. WFAE's education reporter Ann Doss Helms is with us, along with Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC in Chapel Hill. Welcome back to you both. Good morning.
Great to be here.
So, Ann, let me start with you with an explanation of exactly what the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction does.
Well, you know, that is a good question, because we have such a strange system set up, and it has been through multiple evolutions and lawsuits over who has what authority. So the superintendent of public instruction is the head of the Department of Public Instruction, and they do a number of things, like they oversee testing, support for districts, and I had this list in here somewhere, because it's a lot of kind of wonky things that they do. They don't make policy. Often what they have to do is execute the policy that the General Assembly passes. So they are not super visible, but I think we are going to find out there's going to be some significant staff churn whoever gets elected to this, because it will not be the incumbent.
And there are two state agencies dealing with education in our state, the Department of Public Instruction, which is the office that both Mo Green and Michelle Morrow are running to lead, and the North Carolina State Board of Education. Why do we need two? What's the difference?
Well, and again, there's really three. There's the General Assembly that holds most of the power and that keeps redefining the other jobs. And then there is the Board of Education. And I believe at various times in the past, it has had more authority than it does now. They kind of are just almost in an advisory role as well. And of course, the General Assembly is strongly Republican dominated, veto-proof majority. The Board of Education is more bipartisan. There are some people who are on that by virtue of their office. For instance, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson is a member of the State Board of Education right now. But there are appointees by the governor. Then there is the superintendent and the staff that he or she oversees. So the way these interact has just, I mean, really, there have been multiple lawsuits and changes in the time I've been covering this.
So given all these different entities putting their fingers in the pie of education in North Carolina, how important, how powerful is this superintendent of public instruction? Does it matter who leads that agency, Anne?
That's a great question. They definitely have high visibility. But I think you could argue Catherine Truitt, who is the Republican who currently holds the office, I believe she was only the second Republican ever elected to that job. Her predecessor didn't get a lot of traction, it didn't seem like. She's been pretty well respected. She is in the same party as the folks who can do whatever they want in the General Assembly. She has at least some credibility to reach across the aisle. And she didn't get a lot of her agenda done. So I think that kind of, you know, she did the whole reading instruction thing, I think, Now, whether she steered that or whether she was just riding that wave, I think is not 100% clear. But that happened. There have been some changes in how they're describing success for graduates. But she had some big initiatives that just went nowhere.
So, Colin, would I be correct in saying that in years past, this race has not gotten the kind of attention that it's gotten this time around, that it's gotten the attention this time around because of Michelle Morrill? Would that be accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even in the primary, this didn't get that much attention. We were sitting around as journalists in the WUNC newsroom on election night of the primary thinking, oh, wow, this race was that we thought was not going to be competitive at all with a Republican incumbent that seemed to have respect among at least the leaders of her party, suddenly going down in flames on primary night. I mean, we didn't see it coming at all. We didn't put a lot of resources into covering the race between Catherine Truitt and Michelle Morrow, because we get this every few years. There's some sort of insurgent outsider candidate in a primary with a well-entrenched incumbent, and it really doesn't go anywhere. The incumbent generally has the muscle to get across the finish line, and a race like superintendent just doesn't move the needle that much. I mean, we've
What
had
was the margin of victory for Michelle Morrow over Catherine Truitt? Do you remember?
it was not huge,
Okay.
but
I was
it was
thinking
bigger than
like
we
four
expected.
points or something. Yeah, it was not a landslide, but it was, she got it. She got
So
over the
the
line.
so the fact that in the past, I mean, a lot of people probably walked into the voting booth and thought, "Oh, I have to vote for this office? I don't even know what this is." The fact that this is now getting a lot of attention, is that a good thing, Colin?
I think it's positive. I mean, the challenge for any race down ballot in this kind of election year is the presidential election sucks up so much of the energy, so much of the attention, particularly in a swing state like North Carolina, where we get all these candidate visits that sort of dominate the news cycle. One presidential candidate's here one week, the other's here the next week, that we don't necessarily pay enough attention beyond the governor's race. And there's so many of these statewide offices on the ballot this year, from state treasurer to insurance commissioner to superintendent of public instruction. And I think this is sort of put it more of a focus on this because you have this big contrast. And I think particularly Democrats are looking at this as yet another example that they can point to of Republicans nominating more extreme candidates, whether that's Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson for governor or Donald Trump for president.
Had Catherine Truitt won the Republican primary, she likely would be facing a Democratic challenger, but she didn't win. She's the current superintendent. She's held the job since January 2021. She appears to have done a reasonably good job, although, as Anne has said, a lot of her initiatives or a lot of what she wanted to do didn't happen because that's just the nature of that job. But she brought with her a background in the classroom. She was a high school teacher. She's an educator. She's an English teacher. And she has an education degree. She was defeated in the primary, in the Republican primary, by Michelle Morrow, who is a nurse, a former Christian missionary, an activist on various social media platforms and outside of social media, who homeschools her children. What does it say that Republican voters chose her over Truitt? What happened there?
I think there was sort of a very low-key, under-the-radar campaign of her going around doing a lot of grassroots work, going to Republican Party meetings. And there's just a general antipathy, I think, among a lot of the Republican faithful, the base voters towards public education at this time. They're worried that they're, quote unquote, indoctrination centers. And there's just a general desire to kind of blow up the system. And I think that was sort of what folks saw in Morrow's campaign, whereas they saw Truitt sort of as a member of the public education establishment. And I think that was ultimately what was driving it. I think there was also some misinformation out there about what the superintendent of public instruction can actually do. I think Morrow has promised some things that if she gets this job, she wouldn't actually have the power to do, because as Anne was saying, this is not a particularly powerful role. The General Assembly really holds all the cards here.
But because she would be a Republican, would she have sway? Would she hold sway over legislators? In other words, if she really wanted to do something, could she go to the Senate or the House and say, "Here's what I want to do, let's make it happen"?
Yeah, you can do that and you can say that, and it's whether they listen to you. And
Yeah.
again, I don't know. I think that they did listen to one of the things that Catherine Truitt said is that she spent a lot of time going to committee meetings, going to talk to people. She was really trying to push her ideas, but things like changing teacher pay and licensure or changing the way the school performance grades are done just didn't get there. And nobody, I don't think anything's going to happen fast. So they're going to listen. But, and again, remember that primary voters had to be pretty motivated to go to the Republican primary because there was not a competitive presidential campaign. So I think the people, now some may have been, I actually had somebody tell me that they went to vote they voted for Michelle Morrow because they thought Catherine Truitt was too conservative. And then they did the research after the fact and went, oh, I messed up. But I think a lot of people knew that she was MAGA. I mean, she was very open about that.
Colin,
and I think that the primary voters liked it.
What was voter turnout like in the Republican primary, Colin? Was it low?
I mean, it wasn't bad, but it was certainly not, you know, a landslide, because by the time, you know, the Republican primary got to North Carolina, the presidential race, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that Donald Trump was going to walk away with the nomination. So I think it, you know, had you had a more competitive race, had like Nikki Haley still been in the Republican primary in a serious way at that point, you might have seen a bigger turnout. But it certainly wasn't super low. But it is, you know, you see even a lot of ballot drop off with that. There are people who come out for a primary, they vote for the folks at the top of the ticket, and then because they don't have any sort of partisan markers the way they would in the general election, where they could vote a straight ticket Republican or Democrat, people leave a lot of stuff blank. Sometimes people will pick names out of the hat and think, oh, this person's name sounds nicer than the other person, or this person's name came first on the ballot. Morrow's name came first on the ballot over Truitt, just the way the alphabet works. So I think that's an element of it as well. It's just people don't really care this far down the ballot in a primary.
So the squeaky wheel gets all the attention, and she is getting all the attention in this race statewide and nationally because of her comments on other aspects of politics around the last several years. But there is somebody else running in this race. It's the Democrat, Mo Green. What can you tell us about him, Anne?
Well, he's fairly well known across the state and in this area. He is a lawyer. He sent his kids to public schools. They're grown now. He was the deputy superintendent and the board's attorney here in Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, and went to Guilford County Schools and was the superintendent there for 7 years, then went to work for the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation, which is a foundation that does skew liberal progressive, covers a lot of makes a lot of grants for education related things, as well as things like the environment and other civic, basically promotes social and economic justice in its own description. And he retired from that in 2003 to run for this office. And his campaign has been fairly broad strokes. It's been, you know, from what I can tell, it's been, first of all, that woman is dangerous. She doesn't need to run this place. If you go to his website, you will see quite a lot of links to articles about Michelle Morrow. And it's that he will, it kind of echoes the national campaigns in a way. Her tone is very dark. Schools are in chaos. Kids are not safe. You know, everything's falling apart. And his is, we want to remind people that educators ought to be revered and schools ought to be celebrated as a great place.
So I was going to ask you what the issues in this campaign have been so far, and it sounds to me like the issue is Michelle Morrow. Would that be right, Anne?
Well, it's Michelle Morrow, but it's also then how, you know, it's, we're no longer talking, a lot of these races, all the starting points were the same. I mean, when Catherine Truitt ran against Jennifer, what was her last born? Is that right?
I'm spacing right, on. Yeah.
But at any rate, they were two people who had that same background. They were arguing details. And Michelle Morrow, when you go to her website, you see, and she describes the lack of critical thinking as her main issue. And she wants to see a critical thinking agenda. And she says that means questioning what we're being told by the mainstream media, by politicians and by self-serving parties, and question the misinformation and propaganda we are deluged with every minute of every day. So again, this and mismanagement of taxpayer funds, which is always a hit. You know, you can always, people always believe that public money is being wasted. And honestly, it probably is in some cases, but what you will not see on her website is teachers. I did not find any reference to teachers. And she describes it as a movement for parents. So it's this, again, this very fundamental, is it about breaking down the system or supporting it?
Anne Doss Helms is WFAE's education reporter. Colin Campbell is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC. We're talking about the race for the head of the Department of Public Instruction in North Carolina, and we will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the two candidates running to head the Department of Public Construction, Mo Green, the Democrat, Michelle Morrow, the Republican who defeated Catherine Truitt, the Republican incumbent in that office back in the primary. And Doss Helms is here from WFAE News, and Colin Campbell is with us from WUNC. One thing that Democrat Mo Green has been talking about and says he would like to see is more money for public schools and for public school teachers. And here's what he told WRAL-TV's Laura Leslie.
I would lift up things like the woeful underfunding of our public schools in general. I would also lift up how much we are disrespecting our educators and not paying them what they deeply deserve.
So, Colin, what has his opponent, Michelle Morrow, said about funding for teacher salaries?
As Ann alluded to before the break, not a whole lot. That doesn't seem to be a big aspect of her platform, as best we can tell for so far. She's done some media interviews, not a lot, so we don't have necessarily a full picture of it. But I think generally that's not as much of a priority to her as I think some of the curriculum issues of in her mind, trying to stop things that she believes are going on in the classroom that she thinks, you know, should not be topics discussed there.
One thing that we've been talking a lot about over the course of the last year on this program with regard to education has been school vouchers, or these opportunity scholarships that have been expanded by the legislature. Mo Green was on this program several months ago, and we talked about that.
I'm opposed to opportunity scholarships, particularly now that they've been expanded such that anyone could take advantage of the scholarship. And by that, I'm suggesting that anyone, being those who can already afford to send their child to a private school, that they now can take advantage of a scholarship and get government assistance, if you will.
So, Colin, where does Michelle Truitt stand on opportunity scholarships?
Yeah, Michelle Morrow, I think, is pretty much
a supporter of this
program, and I think has advocated for the expansion of the funding for it, which is where things stand now. We have the eligibility that's there, where anybody, regardless of how much money they make, can qualify for these. But so far, at least for this school year that's starting this week, only families at the lower end of the income spectrum can get it, because there's a waiting list for everybody else, and the legislature wasn't able to come up with funding for this program. So this is something I think you'd see Morrow continuing to advocate for. But at the end of the day, ultimately, this is a decision for the legislature and the governor, and all the superintendent of public instruction can actually do is just advocate one way or the other.
Yeah, Democrats in the legislature, Mo Green, who's running for the Department of Public Instruction head, and Governor Cooper, all stand opposed to opportunity scholarships, which would divert $4 billion in taxpayer money over the next 10 years to offering these vouchers to parents regardless of their ability to pay for private school education. Critics have said that this will benefit wealthy parents more, because economically distressed parents can take that money and still not be able to afford the full freight of a public of a private education. So they worry that this will impact students and schools unfairly and affect attendance in the public schools. And what have public school systems had to say about these scholarships?
I think that most of them are fairly opposed, especially given that the General Assembly has been in court for literally decades fighting a lawsuit that says that they need to spend more on public schools, and that they feel like these raises that are here are way too low. And it's why I'm really glad Colin's on this show, because I think going into this session of the General Assembly, the standard wisdom was they were definitely going to expand the vouchers and clear the wait list. And that was because Tim Moore and Phil Berger both said, we're definitely going to put all this money into it and clear the wait list. And then Tim Moore also said, let's tie this to expanding teacher raises. So two very popular things being done in an election year when it's not just Council of State, these General Assembly members themselves are on the ballot. You know, I don't know how contested they are, but so it was like, okay, these two things are going to pass, or at least the vouchers. And in fact, neither of them happened. Or
there are
unless they come back in September.
There are 100 counties in North Carolina. I don't know how many school systems there are. Perhaps you do, Ann, but they're
115.
Okay, so what could $4 billion do in those systems if it was funneled into those public school systems?
You know, I do not have that talking point ready. I bet some district does. Anything that's huge, you know, when you start divvying it up, it comes out to a smaller amount. But yeah, $4 million is not just pocket change, even in a big system. $4 billion is significant. And it's spread over 10 years. So it would not transform everything.
But well, I ask because the public schools, I believe, cost us about $13.5 billion every year in the state. Is that right?
I don't have that number at the top of my head. Do you,
I think,
Colin?
That's right. Colin, do
you? Yeah, that sounds right. But yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, this kind of funding, you know, would be sort of directed in a general way, not so much towards salaries, but supplies, you know, various other things that schools feel short on. My colleague here at WUNC, Liz Slimmer, had a great story last week on school supplies. This is a time of year where everyone's getting that long list as parents of stuff that the schools want you to bring in on the first day. And it's not just pencils and paper. It's things like, my kid's list includes Clorox wipes. Well, a five-year-old kindergarten is not going to be using Clorox wipes in her day-to-day experience, but that's to supply the classroom because the schools aren't supplying the classroom with those kind of basic cleaning supplies. And that's the sort of thing that when you have less money going into the general fund of schools, you're going to have less opportunity to do that kind of thing.
So the demand for these vouchers has outstripped the supply, as you alluded to a moment ago, Colin. The state ran out of money. They plan to allocate more. They haven't gotten around to it. So this school year will begin with people on the lower end of the economic scale being able to take advantage of these scholarships, although, as I said, they won't pay the full freight of most private schools, so they may not be used or they may be worthless to a lot of these people. And there are worries that this will directly impact public schools in another way. Funding will be reduced for those schools as students leave to go to private schools with these vouchers. What, if anything, has CMS, Ann, had to say about that possibility?
Well, the CMS board has opposed the voucher program. And this is a concern that we, you know, when I started this beat, both Wake and Mecklenburg were seeing huge astronomical growth every year. That was the big challenge. How on earth are we going to build enough schools to keep up with all these new students? And then it started to level off here and across the country. And part of that is demographics, but also competition increased. When Republicans took charge of the General Assembly, they have promoted alternatives to traditional public schools, including charter schools, which were kind of the first surge of non-public or non-school district growth, and now with the voucher program. And so, yes, as you see students leave, and it's not even, you know, in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, there's not a lot of growth across the board, but there are areas that are super crowded and there are schools that are really losing a lot. And if you see students leave and go to a private school and maybe it doesn't work and they come back, well, you know, now the public school has got them and they have an obligation, legal and moral and ethical, to serve them. And they're going to be graded on how well those kids do, no matter how much they're struggling. While the private schools have almost no accountability, they can just market themselves as, we're wonderful.
Yeah. There's an organization called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which collaborates with the conservatives in legislatures on political, economic, and social issues, among them public education. And some involved in education have said that they have helped push an effort to undermine and even rid us of public schools. Colin, is this part of that, these opportunity scholarships?
There's definitely a thinking among some in the Republican Party that genuinely think that the best solution to the problems facing public schools is simply to privatize them. One of the big players on the political side for Republicans is a businessman from Raleigh named Bob Bloody. He founded and runs a chain of private schools here in the Triangle area. And he's basically put together a document that sort of his founding mission of this group is thinking that public schools are beyond being able to save, in his mind, that they're not worth saving. And therefore, the best thing to do is divert as much resource as possible towards private education and start that process of privatizing schools. And he is one of the biggest funders for Michelle Moore's Superintendent of Public Instruction campaign, but a lot of other key Republicans in the state.
And I asked you that question because Michelle Morrow has said she views public schools as liberal indoctrination centers pushing leftist ideology.
Instead of an educational focus, we are focused on political or even social activism. And I just think there's no place for either side in the classroom.
That's Michelle Morrow speaking with WRAL-TV's Leslie Allura. Leslie, is there any evidence, Ann, of what she alleges taking place in school classrooms, or is this yet another example of conservatives wanting only their particular view of the world taught, as evidenced by attempts to alter history curricula and ban books?
So that's kind of a loaded question, but there are actually kind of two parallel things going on. And one is anti-racism, diversity, equity, inclusion that is going on within the faculty, more within the adults. And so that has been controversial. There have been programs at Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, for instance, related to anti-racism education that have been controversial. I don't know that there are any more indoctrination than saying, for instance, that you have to, that schools should be striving to make kids be proud of being Americans and that they should not make white kids feel uncomfortable. I mean, there's definitely some whose indoctrination are we doing? And if you want to see the contrast, you know, on their websites, Michelle Morrow's site says the only, oh no, this was not their websites. I think this was the question on the News and Observer's candidate questionnaire about diversity and equity. And Morrow said, the only diversity and equity our schools should be promoting is diversity of ideas and teaching methods and equity of opportunity. And Green, Mo Green says, schools should play a significant role in promoting diversity and equity. And the reality is diversity is there in schools. Yeah, racial, ethnic, income, ideological, the public schools are as diverse as the rest of our world, and it's how you deal with that. So a lot of the questions have centered on how history is taught, how much do we deal with the history of racism in our country, and a lot has been also about LGBTQ issues. They don't want young children. The Republicans, the Michelle Morrow camp, are really concerned that young children are being exposed to sexually inappropriate material. There has not been a huge amount of evidence of that. And there have been, as you mentioned, these book challenges where adults have checklists that they're using to go through the online catalogs and find some of these books, which tend to be in high school classrooms, that do have some content that parents find objectionable.
So, Colin, as Ann mentioned a few minutes ago, the money from these vouchers will go to private schools. And those private schools do not have to jump through the hoops that the public schools have to. They have very limited accountability. They really can say nothing about their success or failure rate, but just tell everybody we're great because we're private. Further, many of them are religious schools, and there are people concerned that this is a violation of separation in church and state because tax dollars are going to support private education at religious schools. How do most North Carolinians feel about that? Has any polling been done on that?
You know, I don't think there's that much awareness, I think, that this is how this is going. But yeah, the top recipients of these vouchers tend to be religious schools. When you think about getting a voucher for a private school, you might think that, oh, you're getting funding to take you to the sort of the top tier private school in your community that costs, you know, $80,000 a year or something like that. That's not where most of these vouchers are going, because the vouchers aren't covering the cost of that. They're covering sort of these, a lot of these sort of startup religious schools that may not have the same amenities as a public school, but certainly have a very specific agenda. They're not adhering to the curriculum standards that public schools have to adhere to. They can discriminate on who they admit. You can require that people be a Christian. You can require that, you know, not be a family with a same-sex couple, something like that. And there's really no guardrails. Other states that have these kind of opportunity scholarship voucher programs have a little bit more of a regulatory framework for how these operate if they're going to be eligible. Here, it's kind of a free-for-all. You can start up a school and you've got, you know, the money, ability to take these vouchers and use that to attract folks to your program.
And regardless of what the polls say, there have been court cases that say this is not unconstitutional. So, you know, that has been taken as the green flag to go ahead. And there's huge variation within religious schools. There are actually some large Islamic schools that are being funded through opportunity scholarships. Most are Christian. And among the Christian ones, there are some extremely Bible-based, you know, a curriculum that is probably not going to be preparing you for a university. There's one at least that screens their teachers partly on speaking in tongues. But there are also religious schools like the Catholic schools in Charlotte, which are known for having actually a good academic curriculum in addition to a religious foundation.
So I want to come back to the idea that Michelle Morrow has expressed that we should be teaching critical thinking in classrooms. And I don't think very many people would disagree with that. I mean, that's the whole purpose of education, coming out asking questions to better understand the world in which you live and the issues that you have to face. But How would that be conducted in a classroom where a lot of teachers are afraid of opening up discussions that would cause critical thinking to take place because they might be accused themselves of trying to indoctrinate children? And this would particularly happen, it seems to me, from what's happened in the past few years by people on the right. Anne, how would they handle that?
It's really difficult because you're right. On these broad strokes, everybody agrees that, yes, critical thinking is good and indoctrination is bad. We're just kind of at a point where in our society, you know, we don't even agree on what a basic factual reporting of events is, let alone, you know, a factual interpretation of history and how to approach that critically and how to research, you know, the folks who don't want what they call critical race theory, which is not really, I think, an issue. It's kind of become a buzzword for racial consciousness or instruction that does deal with institutional racism. But how do you, especially at a high school level, how do you teach history and civics without talking about the ways that our society has skewed the things that we say that we believe in, like equality? So, yes, it's very challenging. And the teachers who in my day might have gotten a call from a parent will now find themselves on social media, you know, being blasted out to people who are going to think they're horrible and, you know, their jobs may be at risk.
Yeah, because one of my best high school teachers made us all ask questions and question everything that we had been taught or heard in the news media. And that includes comments coming from both left and right. And it seems to me today that would be a sticky wicket to navigate for teachers. I have a minute left, Anne, and Lucille emails that please talk about the North Carolina counties that have no public schools, but their residents still pay the taxes to fund opportunity scholarships for rich people in urban counties who already attend private schools, and their public schools are underfunded by the state. There are no counties that don't have public schools. Am I right?
No, she meant to say private schools.
Okay.
There are a very few counties that don't have private schools. There are a number of counties that probably don't have really high quality private schools. That's where when I grew up in a semi-rural county in Indiana, we didn't have any good private schools. So that's what they're talking about. And yes, in the Charlotte region, you have a wealth of private and charter schools to choose from if you don't like your public schools. In some of the rural counties, you don't have many options to your traditional public schools.
Ann Dus Helms is WFAE's education reporter. Colin Campbell is the Capital Bureau Chief for WUNC. We're talking about education in light of the race for the Department of Public Instruction, the head of that department, against, Michelle Morrow, the Republican, against Mo Green, the Democrat. We'll come back and talk about them more specifically in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Colin Campbell from WUNC in Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill, and Ann Dus Helms from WFAE News. And we're talking about the race to lead the Department of Public Instruction between the Democrat Mo Green and the Republican Michelle Morrow, who defeated Catherine Truitt in the Republican primary. I'm going to get this right before the hour is over if he kills me. Now, I mentioned
I'm glad this happens to somebody else because I almost got the wrong name in my story that's published today. So it happened.
I mentioned that we had Mo Green on this program several months ago, and we invited Michelle Morrow to join us as well. She accepted, and then the night before she was to be on, she canceled, and we tried to reschedule her, but she doesn't seem to want to return our calls. But she is welcomed anytime before Election Day to join us. That said, she did sit down with WRAL-TV's Laura Leslie, and in part of that conversation mentioned something that she's talked about before. She alleges that students are failing, classrooms are filled with chaos, drug use, and violence, which is making our state's classrooms unsafe for both students and teachers because students lack discipline.
If a student cannot, you know, contain themselves and participate in a class and allow other students to get what they need, then they need to be pulled out. And I believe that the administration needs to deal with that with the parents.
Now, I would imagine that most people would agree with everything she just said. So, Anne, according to what you know, after years of covering education, are classrooms unsafe for teachers and students. How often is a lack of discipline a serious problem? And is what Michelle Morrow advocates the procedure that CMS and other systems actually already follow?
That is a huge, huge question. Misbehavior, disrespect, et cetera, happens in every school. It happened when we were kids. And obviously, I think things are more challenging. There are guns in schools that were not there. And I think everybody agrees that there is a certain level at which you need to get that student out of the classroom, in which it's just really disruptive behavior. And where we've seen the tension is in what they call these judgment call disciplinary things. And we have seen time and time again that for things like disrespect, general misconduct, et cetera, Black students and Latino students, but especially Black students and Black male students, get far more suspensions than other groups of students. But in the things that are kind of cut and dried, you know, you brought drugs, you brought a weapon, they're fairly proportional. So there is one camp that says, well, those Black kids are just behaving worse. And for the good of everyone, including the other Black students, we just need to crack down on them and, you know, no nonsense, get them out, which then they end up in the communities. There's another side that says, you know, maybe part of the problem is the way we are dispensing discipline and the way we are consciously or unconsciously reacting to students and sending messages to them about whether they are valued or not. You know, I did a lot of stupid stuff. And as a white girl from a doctor's family, I always got the benefit of the doubt. And I think it's pretty clear that there are a lot of students today who don't necessarily get the benefit of the doubt. So that's where the real tension is these disciplinary issues that are not over the top horrible, and it's how we deal with them. And
but she said, but Michelle Morrow said, we need to discipline these children and deal with the parents, remove them from the classroom and deal with the parents. Is that what happens? Because we have talked about this a lot on this program over the years, where teachers sometimes feel anecdotally that they are not believed, that the parents side with the child, not the teacher, and therefore the problem is ongoing.
Yeah, I think probably every classroom teacher could give you examples of where they feel like either the parent was, you know, standing up for their kid no matter what, or parents can be very hard to reach. Again, bear in mind, we have multiple languages. We have, you know, all sorts of family circumstances. Some kids are, you know, living in mansions, and some kids are couch surfing or living in shelters. So I do think that connection with parents is a challenge, and I don't think anybody disagrees with the need to connect with parents on all levels.
So much of the consternation surrounding Michelle Morrow involves many of the controversial statements that she has made over the years, especially on social media, much of which has been scrubbed from social media, but you can still find it. For instance,
the Democratic platform is of the devil. Every part of it is of the devil, and we have got to fight against that.
Now, her opponent, Mo Green, says that she is unfit to be superintendent of public instruction, and on this program, he framed the choice between the two this way.
This is how serious this is, because this is bigger than Mo Green at this point. We must not have this kind of person over our children. This is so important. Public education is not a socialist endeavor. This is not about the devil. This is about the effective education of our tomorrows.
Now, as I said, a lot of those comments, it would be difficult to find them now because they have been scrubbed. But after, in recent months, a lot of the publicly recorded comments that she has made sound quite reasonable. The same was true of Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. He makes controversial statements all the time, many of which have been deemed hateful, particularly those that he makes in private gatherings and in church pulpits and places like that. But when he delivered the State of the State address a couple of years ago, Colin, he was a completely different man, very reasonable, very thoughtful. Which of these versions is the real version of these two people who are running?
I think occasionally you'll get their sort of consultant-led, script-driven speeches where they sound a little bit different than when they're speaking off the cuff and speaking outside of the typical sort of political interview forum type setting. But I think Morrow is, you know, she has some very genuinely held beliefs that are kind of out there, like the clip you played. She's also had social media posts where she's called for the public execution of prominent Democrats like Barack Obama. There's this long list of things that have sort of come up. Yeah, that has come up since she was she won the primary that folks I don't think knew about as much prior to the primary election and her victory there. These are the sort of things that are going to get replayed. I mean, more people are going to see the ads run in this race about what Michelle Morrow has said and Mark Robinson has said on some of these issues than they will sort of their overarching platform. But even Morrow's actual platform as a candidate differs from what you see from a lot of Republicans. She said she'd like to see elective classes in Bible studies brought back into public schools. I have not heard that proposal from other Republicans. That's a little bit further to the conservative religious right than we've seen in this state. So there's a lot of that in this race.
So both Michelle Morrow and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson have suggested turning down funds from the federal government, even as Donald Trump and Republicans at the national level have advocated ending the U.S. Department of Education, which makes those funds available. And WRAL-TV obtained a video recording of Robinson talking about this at a private meeting of donors.
If I had my way about it, I'd just say they send the check and I'm like, that's okay, you had it. I don't want your money.
Yeah.
Your money comes with too many rotten obligations. We don't want it. There should, honestly, come on, there should be no federal Department of Education.
And that's a popular view among many Republicans. What role does the Department of Education play in local public schools?
You know, that's interesting because I was just having that discussion with somebody who thought that they really were in charge of all public schools. And they're not. The primary responsibility and the primary funding comes from the state. And then local governments are next. So the federal segment kind of grew during the pandemic because of all the infusion of pandemic aid, but about 10% generally of Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools' budget is from the federal government. And it does come with strings attached, for instance, related to all the different titles. You know, Title I targets high poverty schools and provides resources that are often used to hire extra teachers, extra staff in schools that have the students with the most disadvantages. Title IX has to do with gender equity and sexual harassment and things like that. The big thing is there is what I used to cover as the No Child Left Behind Act. It's now the Every Student Succeeds Act. But a lot of this accountability, a lot of the data reporting that comes every year that we're going to see a whole lot of next week is mandated in part by the federal government. So there are strings attached, but also most of the things that people are arguing over are decisions made either by state legislatures or local school boards.
And here is what Michelle Morrow has had to say about the strings attached to that federal funding coming from the U.S. Department of Education.
People need to recognize that the federal government, along with every dollar that they give us, there is an expectation that we are going to push an agenda that comes from them.
So what is the agenda? Is it diversity, equity, and inclusion? Does it deal with what has to be taught or not taught? Is it Title IX, what is it?
You know, I don't know that there's any one agenda, and those broad, the thing, No Child Left Behind, ESEA, have been bipartisan. So I think it's not, again, the micro decisions when Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools hires a consultant that people really don't like, that's not coming from the federal government. I do think if you looked into enough of the programs and enough of the language, there's got to be volumes and volumes, and we'd all probably find something we're not super crazy about. But no, for the most part, I don't feel like the federal government is dictating a DEI curriculum. And again, curriculum standards come from the state, and there has been a lot of controversy over some of those, including the history standards a few years ago.
Yeah, my understanding is that the general funding from the federal government is given sort of lumped into a category. And what Republicans are really advocating for here is they would like the federal government to just write us a check and let North Carolina's education system use it however they want. And it's a little bit more targeted than that, than it goes for certain things, certain types of programs. It's not just a blank check to do whatever you want.
Well, there needs to be accountability. We call for, Republicans and Democrats both call for accountability, and that would be accountability. You take our money, it comes with some strings here. But one of the things that she is, Michelle Morrow, is concerned about is, in fact, diversity, equity, and inclusion.
It's all talking about inclusion. And what they're wanting to include are things that are not on the spectrum of accepted in a biblical worldview. They're wanting to include everything. It's called tolerance.
Biblical worldview. So Laura Leslie from WRAL-TV pushed back on that. She asked Michelle Morrow about what she means by federal overreach.
As I'm going across the state, and I have been actually for the last 3 years, what I'm hearing from the teachers is they are tired of being forced to do things in their classroom that and participate in programs that have nothing to do with children's academic success. They want that heavy hand of the U.S. Department of Education to be removed from them so they can do what they were called to do. I think every teacher wants the best for their students. I think that teaching is a calling, and I think that we have been wrong in not prioritizing our spending to be students first and in the classroom first, rather than on special interest groups and different programs that are not helping our students to be academically successful.
Is she right? Is she wrong? Is that pressure coming from the federal government, or is it coming in from the state government? Is it coming from school boards? Is it coming from parents? Where is it coming from, this feeling? And it's true that teachers no longer have control.
Yeah, and I think the answer is all of the above. Yes, again, every classroom teacher could tell you, I wish they would get out of my hair with X. And it might be a professional development program that they don't love that's coming from their superintendent, or it might be whatever. I mean, this idea that teachers should be freed to teach a biblical worldview is, I think, way out of sync with the mainstream. I think most people would say, if you want to teach a biblical worldview, go teach at a Christian school. But yes, there are all sorts of administrative burdens and responsibilities, and some of them probably are there for really good reasons. But I don't think that, for the most part, this is coming from the Department of Education. I think when you hear abolish the Department of Education, you're hearing part of that broader theme, which is don't trust the government to educate your kids. And the higher up you get, people might trust their teachers and their principals, a little less so the school board and the federal government. Is just they're out to do something bad to your kids. And that's when you start to hear people like, and I think Mark Robinson was the first person I heard say, I don't necessarily support public school systems, I support students and families. And the idea that they're not one and the same is one of the really big philosophical differences out there.
And once again, WRAL-TV's Laura Leslie pushed back a little bit on Morrow's comment about federal interference attached to their money.
You are aware, though, that it's federal money that pays for a lot of the, for example, school lunches for children.
Yes.
who are, you know, low income.
I do.
And for the extra teachers and things like that.
I do. But at the same time, people need to recognize that the federal government, along with every dollar that they give us, there is an expectation that we are going to push an agenda that comes from them. And along with that comes a lot of strings. And so what I'm saying is, let's get to the bottom of what is helpful and what is not helpful, and then we'll determine what our relationship is going to look like with the U.S. Department of Education. I don't think that we can just blindly say, yes, we need to do everything they tell us to do because we need those dollars. I think money matters, but it matters more how you're spending it.
I suppose, Colin, it could be argued that we do need those dollars given the amount of money that we get. How much money does North Carolina get from the U.S. Department of Education?
It's north of $1 billion a year, so this is a
big chunk. It's $1.7 billion.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a big chunk of our overall education budget. And so if you were to just simply tomorrow decide that we're not going to cash those checks anymore, we're not going to take that money, then you either have to make some major cuts in what you fund, or you have to raise revenue at the state level to make up that amount of money. And so what sort of remains to be seen is what's the actual plan for this. And my question is, does the governor or the superintendent of public instruction really have the power to do any of that? I think ultimately, most likely the answer is that it's the legislature, and the legislature is going to have to say no to what, you know, is essentially free money. It may come with some strings attached, but it's a pretty crucial element of our overall funding picture for public schools in the state.
So, Anne, you got all this money flowing into opportunity scholarships, draining money from the public schools. You've got the public schools already underfunded, and the Leandro case languishing out there for two decades, where the courts have said that the legislature has underfunded the public schools and they must do so, but they won't. And then you've got this urge on the part of Michelle Morrow to turn down $1.7 billion in federal money. What would the impact of that be, of all of this combined?
Well, you know, there have always been people saying they're out to dismantle public education, and I think Colin addressed that really well. There are some people that want to end the system as we know it and have it much more heavily privatized. I think the amazing thing is that As we speak, teachers are doing a great job in classrooms today.
And Colin, I have 10 seconds. Which way is the wind blowing? Any polling on this race?
Probably vote Greens to lose at this point, but you never know. There's always surprises when you get this far down the ballot.
Colin Campbell's Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC and Doss Helms is Education Reporter for WFAE News. Thank you both for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.